family.
I tried to brainstorm a few different stories, and I came up with a couple.
Okay. Well, this is early September, and we're talking, visiting with Jerry Schmidt in regard to our program of recording some archival information about the West Dubuque School District. Jerry was a teacher at the high school and a coach. How many years, Jerry?
I did 32 years there.
Yeah. 32 years.
Yep.
And I was always intrigued by the story about your first day. Maybe you can recount that.
Well, thankfully there was a second one. I was teaching freshman English at the time, and I also had a junior-senior class that was called Modern Communications, and I team-taught that with Tom Berry because I had no clue what Modern Communications should be about. It covered basics of the newspaper and TV and movies, all forms of the media, and Tom had some background and knew things, but I was just trying to help out as best I could and tried to appear competent. But that first day, I was still of the 60s hippie generation, and I had graduated from Loras in the middle of the year and gone to work at a Crayler furniture factory south of Chicago, and then came back to start the school year after getting hired in April of 73, came back to start the school year in the fall of 73, and I honestly had nothing resembling dress clothes. I think I had two shirts that were passable as dress shirts, kind of washed out blue denim, and I had a couple pair of pants, just some old Levi's, bell-bottom Levi's, but everything else I had were the old blue jeans with patches on them and magic marker and peace symbols, and I had no, the classic was I had no dress shoes. I didn't have a pair of leather dress shoes. I had a couple pair of old Chuck Taylor Converse All-Star basketball shoes, and I had sandals and moccasins, but nothing resembling shoes. Well, I thought that would still be okay on the first day of school, and I was going to have to wait till that first paycheck to buy some things, and I showed up on the first day with a washed-out denim blue shirt and these kind of rust-colored Levi pants that were at least not patched, and sandals, and I taught, and I had really, really long hair at that time and a long beard and looked almost biblical, and when the day was over, I got this call to come in and see Ralph Buckman, my first principal and one of the finest men who ever walked the earth. But he wasn't happy that day. I was on my way in, and I figured I was going to have a couple questions asked that Buck would want to know how the first day went and congratulate me and tell me to come back and do even better the second day. And when I got to the office, Buck was already a little red-faced. And I sat down, and he said, it's come to my attention that you're not wearing shoes, Buck said. And I said, well, I have sandals on. He said, those aren't shoes. And you're also not wearing a tie, and it's expected at this school that gentlemen wear a tie to teach. And I noticed most of the teachers that day, and teachers on, had ties on, and it didn't dawn on me that I should be wearing one also. So Buck advised me that it would be very good if I came back the next day with a tie, wearing a tie, and hat with a pair of shoes. So I went home, checked my checking account and my savings account, neither of which had much in them, and I headed right down to Walker Shoes, downtown Dubuque, and bought a pair of blue suede shoes. Figuring this would satisfy Mr. Buckman and also be kind of my rebellious way of saying, why do I have to wear these? And then I went down to St. Vincent de Paul because I didn't want to spend, you know, $7 or $8 on a tie at that time. So I went down to St. Vincent de Paul, and sure enough, they had a whole rack of pretty hideous looking ties, about 40 cents a piece, I think, and I bought five ties. I think I had four regular ties and one of the most hideous looking green bow ties you could even imagine. And again, it was my rebellious way of saying, okay, I'll wear it, but I'm not going to look good in it. So sure enough, the next day I came back with my blue suede shoes and a tie on and my denim shirt and rust-colored pants. And Buck saw me in the hallway as I came in. I'm sure he was just there checking to see how I looked. And he gave kind of a little wink and a sort of a thumbs up and said, "That's much better." And I was proudly heading down the hallway then towards my portable for the school day, knowing I'd passed.
Let's back up a little bit, Jerry, as far as your background prior to coming to Loras.
I grew up in Kankakee, Illinois, which is about 60 miles south of Chicago. It's about halfway between Chicago and Champaign, where the University of Illinois is located. And at that time, it was a town that pretty much hitched its wagon to industry, and it is since basically gone belly up because most of industry did the same thing. But in that day, my dad worked at an international harvester plant. My mom was a part-time worker at a middle school, a junior high that was right across the street from where we lived. I had four younger brothers and sisters, small house, one car, and it was a station wagon, of course. And I went to a small Catholic grade school, St. Martin's, for my 8 years of elementary school, and then went to a parochial high school, Bishop McNamara, probably about 700 or 800 students at that time, and then graduated from McNamara in 68. I knew I wanted to play basketball. I had played basketball and run track in high school, but I knew I wanted to play basketball, and I knew there was no big school that was going to grab me up. So I came to Loras and made the freshman team, had a really good year my freshman year in basketball, and then my sophomore year I basically became part of the hamburger squad. I sat the bench, never got in, maybe one or two games all year, and played JV a little bit, and then after my sophomore year decided that the NBA wasn't in my future, so I hung basketball up and hit the books a lot harder. I was on academic scholarship, or I'd have never been able to go to Loras. My dad would have never been able to afford it at that time, but I was on presidential scholarship at Loras and managed to keep my grades up to the point where I kept that scholarship for 4 years and worked enough during the summer at different places back in Kankakee. Mostly in industry, mostly just a janitor, different places. And then after 72 was my graduating year at Loras. I student taught the first semester of the 72-73 school year with Linda Olson. And at that time, I was fortunate enough when the spring rolled around that Tom Roach, who was an English teacher there at the high school, was retiring. And so it opened up a spot in basketball and in the English classroom for me. And I interviewed and was lucky enough to get the job and loved it and never left.
Where'd you do your student teaching at?
I was in one of the portables for Linda Olson.
Okay.
Yeah, I student taught. That would have been the fall of 72 in Linda's classroom. And I was, you know, because, again, of my hippie background, my hair was very long, my beard was very long, and here I was with Linda Olson, prim and proper. I think the only thing would have been tougher if I'd had been with Lois Tyson. I'd probably had to get a haircut, and she'd have decided on my clothing every day. But Linda lived with it, and we became good friends. And the job opened up at the high school, and I seemed to be in the right place at the right time and interviewed and got the job that following April. In fact, I came back for the interview, and it was, I don't remember, in April of 73, there was a huge winter storm that hit here that weekend.
April 8th.
Nothing moved.
Yeah.
When you drove old Highway 20 heading out to west of Dubuque, the snow drifts were above the level of the car on both sides. And so I had no place to stay that weekend, and I stayed with the Wickhams. Tom let me stay after my interview. I stayed with the Wickhams that night and then headed back to Kankakee when the interview weekend was over.
That was, that was because I knew of that because it was Jill's baptism.
Oh, my gosh.
And we had... had the baptism, went out to Susie's parents' farm, and my parents were there, and so about, I don't know, it was getting bad in the afternoon, about 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock, and we barely made it back to Farley.
Yeah,
my parents stayed with us for till Wednesday, I think.
Well, I remember driving here, and I kept telling myself, this is for an interview. It's important. You got to get there. And then the roads just never got any better. And my interview was on a Friday after the Thursday trip, and wow. I thought, this is the way it's going to start. Everything's got to be better from here.
So that first year, you did some coaching.
Buck's in the middle of one of those stories, too. Because Ralph had been the girls' basketball coach before I came. And not only was I a first-year coach, but the head coach, the new head coach, was Dean Hogan, who was a phys ed teacher. And it was Dean's first year also. So the two of us came and started our coaching careers, and I can still remember going to the first meeting with all the parents, and Dean was already spouting off about how he was pretty sure that he could get this program on its feet quickly, and he was hoping that within a couple of years we could be at the state tournament. And a couple parents came up to me after the meeting was over and asked if that guy was crazy. I think we won two games the first year at the varsity level, and the sophomores, my kids, won about five. But the classic Buck story, I believe it was something toward Makoka. It might have been Oxford Junction or somebody over that direction. We played in a game, and that night I didn't see eye to eye with the officials, and I was pretty unsportsmanlike, and I got teed up twice that night. In the game against Oxford Junction, and I think it was a Tuesday night game, and I got to school the next day, and you know, we had turned our score sheets in that morning, and first period was over, and I happened to be heading into the office, and got another one of those calls, and Don Hermson was at the front desk when I walked in, and he's singing T for two and two for T. So I knew he's already giggling. I'm pretty sure I know why I have to go into the office. And I walked in, and Buck basically read me the riot act for getting two technicals and what a poor example that was, and make sure that this doesn't happen again. And I don't know, a couple weeks later we were playing DeWitt in a home game. And I got another one pretty early in the game. And I saw Buck coming from the door very soon after the technical. And he sat right behind the bench the rest of the game. And he looped his hand in the back of my belt, around my belt. And every time I started to move, if it wasn't a timeout or a break in the act, if I even started to move, Buck was right behind me in my ear going, "Okay, sit down, coach your kids, be quiet." And it was a lesson well learned. I didn't get another one that night, and I don't think I got another one the rest of the season, because I wanted to make sure I kept Buck happy. And I was kind of enjoying teaching and coaching there, and I didn't want to be asked to leave. But I think we won five games. The varsity might have won two, and I think we had two more losing seasons after that, and then we found ways to win games, and
that was
the girls' program.
Dean Hogan stayed for
2 years.
2 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then after that?
Did Bailey come right after that?
Chuck came right up.
Chuck came after that, and then Bill Hafer. Yeah, Chuck came for several years right after Dean left.
So that was, when you started, that was prior to collective bargaining.
Mm-hmm.
And can you have some thoughts about how things developed regarding the collective bargaining as far as it affected the staff and the administration and whatever changed, if anything changed? Or
I don't remember a whole lot of changes because of it. What stands out in my mind from those early years, and practically anybody who taught will recall this, I was in a portable, as were so many teachers at that time. There were 14 portables down there on the north end and another couple down on the south end. And there are just so many stories about teaching in portables that no one would ever believe. I'd tell people when I left here and I would go home for the summer, I'd tell people about some of the stories that year, and they were shaking their head. They couldn't believe that these kinds of things would happen in classrooms. And I said, well, most of them are a product of portable living. And the class, I wish Ali could tell you this story, because he's much funnier at telling it. There was an incident with a rabid raccoon. Did you ever hear that story?
For that one.
Oh, man. Running around outside, and they announced over the loudspeakers, told all the teachers to keep their kids in until this raccoon had been corralled. And the town cop came down and opened fire at this raccoon. Oh, and there was a bullet that got lodged in Al's portable wall. And he talked about that the rest of the school year. About
Well, can you imagine if that happened now?
Oh, God.
It would be on the national.
Oh, gosh, yes.
It would, I mean.
Gunfire at Western Dubuque High School.
Oh, my God. Yeah, because, you know, back then, if let's say I walked out of the parking lot, it would be nothing to see pickups with the rifles in the back window.
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah.
Nobody thought a thing of it.
No.
whatever my coffee had is... Delury had their unit on, I don't know.
The Old West. And yeah.
They bring the weapons in. And it was just, every year they'd say, well, we're going to do this with, you know, with the guns. And, so, it was different back then.
But we always had this in the fall and in the spring, you'd have the side door, which was supposed to be the fire exit. It was about a 12-foot drop. But you'd have the fire door open to get a little bit of ventilation. And I can still remember a bird came flying in and was circling the room. This happened every once in a while. But that particular day, it started circling the room. And it was dive-bombing the kids, and I was trying to get them under their desk. And bird dropped a couple of spots, and it just so happened that one of the kids it hit was Jody Knutson. That Jody, I think, right on the shoulder, and then somebody else across from her hit the desk and splattered. And then it went out the window. The bird story, I also had one. This was, I don't remember, again, it was in the fall of one of the school years I taught, and I was in the portable. I walked in one morning, and I heard this chirping in the room, a bird, and I looked in the back of the portable, and there was a hole about the size of a 50-cent piece in the back wall, and a bird somehow had built its nest from the outside in between the two walls, and it had its head sticking through this hole looking at me as I came in that day.
Oh,
it's a bird looking in through this, and I told, I think Dave Lieben was one of the janitors at the time, I told Dave about it that day at lunchtime, and Dave came out and fortunately got the nest out of there, but it had somehow or other in the course of a couple of days built a nest in there, I suppose was going to have babies, until we uprooted it and sent it to some other place. Oh, you remember Dawn Stumpner?
Sure.
Oh, God, the classic Dawn Stumpner. I had her in freshman English. Classic story with her. We were in the portables on the south end. Jane Deneve was next to me, and I had an English portable next to Jane's French classroom. And I had Dawn in the class period right after lunch. And in that lunch period, she had, at the end of the lunch, music with Phil, music lessons. And that day, it was so beautiful out that they had all of their music stands outside, and they were having practice outside. When music practice was over, Dawn brought her instrument in and put it away in the music room, and all the kids filed into my room, and I was taking a roll, and Dawn wasn't there. Dawn hadn't shown up yet, and it wasn't, I mean, she always took a little longer to get there, of course, but she wasn't there. I said, the kids, is Dawn here today? Oh, yeah, she just was in music class. I looked out the door, and I went, oh, and the kids go, what's wrong? I said, oh, no. All the music stands were still set up. No one had put them away. They were on the grass and the sidewalk between the back door of the music room and my portable. And here is Dawn trying to navigate with her cane around every one of the music stands all the way across. So I immediately sent one of the kids over there to help her. And when the kid got there, Dawn said, no, I can do it. I can do it. So along with her cane, she kept going. And all the kids are sitting there, come on, Dawn, come on, Dawn. They're cheering. And she finally got to the front door. And all the kids are giving her a standing ovation and pumping their fists. That's because she got through this series of landmines to get to class. And without a breath, Dawn looks, says, All right. Whose idea was it to put the obstacle course out here today?
Poor John.
Oh, my God. What a sweetheart she was, though. God, yeah.
Have you heard much about her?
Well, I know she eventually graduated from college. I think she was teaching or majored in Korean. I know it was language.
Okay.
I think it was Korean. And then where she took that, I don't know.
I had heard that possibly she was one of it, maybe connected to the United Nations in New York City and be an interpreter.
Yeah.
But I really don't know
I've completely lost touch with that after she left high school, where she went. But other than that, I was pretty sure it was Korean was the language that she studied.
Yeah.
Oh, she was a great kid, though. Talk about making adaptations and making it work.
Well, just reviewing things as far as I can recall, then we're getting into the 80s, and you're still connected with the girls' basketball program, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
How about the transition from 6-on-6 to 5-on-5?
It would have been, let's see, 84 or 85. That we made the switch, and that year the varsity team with Bill Hafer and Jim Demmer and Bill Betts helping in there too, they played 6-on-6 all year,
right,
and made it to the state tournament in 85, made it to state with the 6-on-6 game. But because we were switching to 5-on-5 the next year, my job at the sophomore level was to get the kids to transition to the 5-on-5 game. So we played the first half of our season was 6-on-6, but at practice we did an awful lot of work on the full court game too. But the practice was a 6-on-6 because we knew we had games in that yet. And then at the halfway point, we switched and played all 5-on-5 the second half of the season. And you talk about some confused kids. And I had kids who had played nothing but guard before in the 6-on-6 game, who really, really had a tough transition. And that probably the classic example of it was Joan Steffen. Joan had played all guard in 6-on-6, and when I was trying to convince her that she could play 5-on-5, she never wanted to shoot the ball. She was glad to play point guard. She was glad to dish the ball, set things up, but did not want to shoot the ball. So it took most of that second half of the season to convince Joan that yes, she could shoot, yes, she could score. In fact, it was a requirement almost in the 5-on-5 game. And then, 2 years later, she's standing at the foul line making free throws against North Scott to cinch the state championship. And I could remember back in 2 years before when she didn't even want to shoot a free throw, let alone shoot them with that kind of pressure. But there were some kids who really blossomed in that time. Really took on the challenge, and obviously if 2 years later we were winning state titles, a lot of them adapted pretty darn well and took us a long way.
Well, I was thinking back to those kids, and there were some great athletes. Great athletes.
Yeah.
Erica Kilberg.
Oh. Never had to convince her that she had to shoot.
Lisa Wegman.
Lisa Wegman was a terrific player.
Obviously Shelley. And Kleesner.
Kim Kleesner was just a worker.
On a horse.
Oh, man. And speaking of horse, Joe Horsfield. Oh my God. Talk about somebody who wasn't afraid. Just bring it on.
Somehow they come together in a group.
Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah. Carla Birds might have been one of the best shooters I ever coached. Didn't matter whether it was 6 or 5. Carla could shoot the lights out. And didn't play as much maybe as a varsity player as she did when she played at the freshman and sophomore level. But, boy, she was money if she could get open.
Kid.
Yeah.
How about that week in Des Moines? that was a week like no other, obviously.
I think the one thing that still stands out in my mind, I can still see it happening, the day of the championship game, after we'd already beaten Water Columbus, and nobody was supposed to do that.
Afterthoughts.
Yeah, that was not supposed to happen. And we did the impossible in beating Columbus, and then we were all set for the championship game against North Scott. We had worked out that day at one of the local high schools or maybe at Drake or someplace. I know we had a workout, though. And when we got back that day, the kids were trying to find something to fill time and ease the nerves if they could. And I walked down with my wife, and we were standing on a railing down looking overlooking the swimming pool.
In the lobby there.
In the lobby. And the kids had music on, and they were dancing and laughing and just being goofy. And it was almost like, I said to Lisa, the edge is off. They're relaxed. They're going to be terrific. They're not nervous. Look at them. They're dancing with each other, and they're laughing and having a great time. They're just eating up this environment. This is unbelievable.
And that pep rally that was so unbelievable.
It was just a magical couple of days with a great group of kids and terrific parents, and everything just went right. And I mean, like, I still remember sitting around in that lounge area after the championship game, and everybody's just sitting there kind of snacking on hors d'oeuvres and having a beer or a drink or two and just shaking our heads like, what did we just do? What just happened?
I remember the that was the transition still from 6-on-6 to 5-on-5, and how the officials hustled us off the floor after the championship game.
Right, right. We've got another game to go here. Yes, you guys are in the way.
I remember that. Wow. Yeah. Oh yeah, and the other thing I remember about that season was the game at Cedar Falls.
Oh yeah.
Wow, that was against Fenton, right?
Yep, Fenton Shellsburg.
Man, we didn't do anything wrong that game.
And that was about the only way we could win it.
Wow.
Those kids just came up to every challenge. They met every challenge, and that's why that trophy's in the case these days.
That was, that was the Jim Demmer's birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody asked Susie to make a cake.
Mm-hmm.
And so we brought the cake up. And so after the game, we got this cake. And
the lounge.
The guys are trying to be interviewed by the press and whatever. And somebody says, well, where do we put the cake? I don't know if it was Demmer or I guess Bill said, in the locker room anywhere.
Oh man.
Yeah. Pretty good stuff. How about other memories going into the 90s as far as you still kept coaching?
I coached through 91. I wanted to coach the Schuler triplets because I'd known the Schulers, Bill especially, for many, many years. And I also wanted to coach Sarah Round because I had known PJ and Lois for a long, long time too. And that last team I had, we only had, I think, 10 kids out or something like that. We had a very small number. And then Peggy Gall got hurt, blew out an ankle at a practice over at the seminary, and she became my assistant coach the rest of the year. So I think we had 9 healthy bodies the whole season, and they went undefeated in the conference with those kids. And then Jim decided, in his wisdom, Jerry stuck around so he could coach the Schuler triplets. I'm going to bring one of them up. So Julie went up to the varsity, and I still had Jill and Jody. But Lisa and I had agreed we never got to spend Christmas together, never spent Thanksgiving together. She'd go to her family, I'd stay back for practice, and we kind of decided at 19 years, I guess, I'd coached it. That was a pretty good number, and it was time to let somebody else have a shot at it. So I still remained one of their most loyal fans, but did it from the sidelines and stuff like that.
They did the football press box and announcing, and
did that from 81 when Jim Kilbreath was the coach. From 81 till 2011, I did it for 30 years up there, and obviously there were an awful lot of changes in that program too over that 30 years.
Oh my.
state titles. And
I have to do interview Tom sometime.
Oh, man.
What we had to put up with, no one would ever believe, for example, that Tom, during the summer, to keep the grass growing on the football field, he would personally himself go up 3 or 4 times a day to change the direction of the hose.
So you could water it.
To keep the water going.
Oh my God,
field.
I never knew that.
And I also remember how much little support we got from the maintenance department for whatever. But finally, we always had a problem in the field. The northeast corner, when they had graded it originally, it wasn't sloped properly and the ice got wet.
Yeah.
So anyway, finally Tom and I had talked about it, and we decided that we needed to regrade the field.
Mm-hmm.
And so what it happened, fortunately for us, it happened that at the end of the season, I think we were playing away the last game. So I had talked to Mr. Varr, our great ground superintendent, and told him we needed some fill dirt, you know, to help, you know, shape that crown. So he agreed to, I think, give us 5 loads.
Mm-hmm.
So, at any rate, I had Susie's Uncle Jerry Onstetter bring in the loads of dirt. And after the dirt was deposited, it was obvious that it was like, you know, a drop in the ocean.
Sure.
Compared to what was needed. Fortunately, at that time, Mr. Barr was away for a conference of some sort. And I just told Jerry, keep the dirt coming.
He'll never know.
So, I think it was like 25 to 30 loads that he brought in.
Oh, my.
But it was graded after
sure.
that. And as it turned out, that fall, we seeded it down.
Mm-hmm.
Growing conditions were perfect, and by the next fall, you'd never know that it was, you know. So anyway, that's how that happened. Yeah. Oh, my.
Well, I remember the early years when I was working up in the press box. We had a tiny little press box on the home side, and it was just... They just had temporary bleachers over on the visitor's side, but a tiny little press box, and there was a ladder that went up above, and there was a railing up there, thank God, because the film crew would go up there, and sometimes the assistant coaches from the other school with their headsets would go up there. I mean, there was very little room in that press box, and God knows dangerous conditions for anybody who had to go up on top when it was windy or cold. But that was the best we had, and so you made do with it. And
it was. If you could chronicle all of those things that we did without, you know, those years, I guess you should tell the kids. Well, that's what hardened your ability to cope with whatever.
Yeah.
In your adult life.
Well, not just the football, too. That gorgeous track that's there now, compared to that old cinder thing that we used for how many years?
I remember the spring, you'd go up for those track meets, and the wind mm-hmm. would just be howling.
Yeah.
Brutal conditions.
Yeah. But it could be, I mean, it could be 15 below and Tom Dander would still be wearing shorts.
No doubt. Coach Dander would be on the sidelines.
I worked many a freshman game, and boy, he always had just an amazing rapport with those kids and always did a great job.
So now he's a sophomore.
Now he's a sophomore coach.
So that's a change for him.
Oh.
I never quite, if I understand it correctly, they switched the sophomore games, and they play the freshman games before the varsity games now.
I don't know that. I haven't been to a game yet. They should have. If they did, that must be new this year.
I think that's been going on for a while.
Oh, has it?
I'm not sure how that all works, but
okay.
At any rate.
I thought I went once last year, and it seems like the sophomore game was first.
Okay. Well, maybe.
Maybe that's 2 years ago, though,
maybe
now.
Maybe they switched it back. I don't know. But at any rate.
Well, I know Tom is coaching the same kids he had last year, but I don't know, you know, which night they play.
Yeah.
He has he had those kids as freshmen last year, and they went undefeated last year, and he has them again now this year as sophomores.
Yeah.
With Rob Horner, who's another guy who's given so much to programs and stuff over time. And
Rob's going in the Hall of Fame this year.
Good. That's deserved. That's well deserved.
So that's great.
Mm-hmm.
But, so, yeah, okay, then you, when did you retire, Jerry?
I retired in 2005, then decided, I still had enough gas in the tank. I wanted to do something. So I went into Dubuque and worked at Prescott for 3 years in their BD department. And then did 5 years at Eisenhower at several levels, fourth and fifth grade mostly, though. Taught creative writing there to tag kids. I had tag math. And boy, that was pathetic because I can't even balance a checkbook. But thank God there was a teacher's manual. Working with 12 kids, all of whom were smarter than I. and then I still coached 4th and 5th grade basketball track. There are 40 or 50 kids every year out for bowl sports. And
good.
I think I missed, I know I missed kids, but I think honestly what I missed more after I left West Dubuque were my colleagues. I missed the teachers I'd worked with, the administrators I'd worked with. I missed all those people. And so I just needed to do something else just to get out of the house during the day. And
did you still maintain your payday top 10?
No. I probably still have a few of those at home in a box somewhere that I could drag. I know my favorite one, the top 10 ways you can tell an Amish boy is not behaving himself. I still have that one somewhere, I know. When he's hanging around the convenience store with a pack of cigarettes in his pocket. Or you see three of the buggies on the side of the local tavern. They're parked out on the side of the local tavern and the horses are tied up. You could tell. There were so many of those that were just so much fun to wait. A way to start a Friday and giggle.
That was nice. That was great.
Laugh a little bit and then get after it. I think there were a few teachers who didn't appreciate it as much as others, but the majority did, I think.
Well, it was just a lot of good fun with friends.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay. That's good stuff.
Good?
Yep.
All right. Can't think of anything else. The other one that I thought about as I came out here, though, I don't know if I'd get the details right. Before I started teaching at West Dubuque that last year, I played for Edwards Construction in basketball, and Dick Walu and Tom Wickham were on that team.
As I was.
Oh, you were on the Edwards team?
Yeah.
Were you on it when I played?
I don't remember for sure.
I think you joined with Hying after we left.
The next year.
Because Hying always says he was on the team too, and I know Hying didn't play when I played.
No, Hying and I played together.
I bet it was the next year. Jim Rudin was on the team.
Yep.
Well, that last year that I was playing, Gary Yonke, who was my roommate for many years, I played high school basketball with him and a couple of years at Loras. And the two of us were on the Edwards team with Dick Walu and with Wick and Hermie and Larry McCready and Jim Rudin. And we played in I think it was a Christmas holiday tournament or something. And we got to the finals against Bogey Redman and Mike Zarn and all those guys who'd been on the senior team that had gone to state in high school
not long before.
Pat Malloy, yep. So we played those guys I think it was the finals of the tournament. And somewhere along later in the game, there was kind of bad blood between the two teams anyway, but late in the game, Dick Walu got in a kind of a throwdown with one of their guys. I think it was Bogey. And then Wick got pushed or grabbed, and he was in the middle of it. So the picture that ended up on the sports page at the end of the tournament was Wick and Walu in the middle of a fight, with Redmond and Zarin and Malloy and all these guys, two administrators from West Dubuque, and standing over the whole pile there in the middle of the floor was my old roommate Gary Yonke, who had this huge long beard. Again, he looked like Moses parting the sea or something. He's standing over the pile with his hands outstretched like he's trying to break this up somehow peacefully. Oh, God. You know, that was the talk of the building when we came back. So staff members were talking about the picture of Wick and Walloo down in the middle of the fisticuffs, pushing and shoving guys. And Hermie must have been at the other end of the floor. He'd have been in on that, too. Yeah. And McCready. That fight could still be going on if Mac had come.
You know, that's a lot of different memories of that. But moving forward, out here at Thunder Hills, Jim Edwards lives out here.
Okay, yeah.
And Jim, of course, was the founder of Edwards Construction, mm-hmm. and he sponsored the team. And he and I visited, you know, last set of Christmas party.
Mm-hmm.
Struck up a conversation. Anyway, Jim told me about how he came to be in this area because he's from Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
He said or told me that when he had always wanted to be a Marine.
Mm-hmm.
So when he graduated from high school, he went to the Marines. And in the Marines, he got into some area of construction somewhat and was interested. Got out of the Marines and realized he needed more training. Found that there was a school in Milwaukee that could take courses. So he went there and did his courses. Needed some money and went to work for a construction crew around there.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, the owner of the crew company took a liking to Jim with his ambition and asked him to run a crew.
Yeah.
And so he did, for, I think, for a year or two. And then the guy said, I have another branch in Dubuque. Would you be willing to go there and take over? And so and Jim said, sure.
Huh.
And so he came to Dubuque and ran this company, small company. He said, I ran it for the first year, and he said, at the end of the year, we didn't make any money. So I went back to Milwaukee, met with a gentleman, and he figured I'd get fired, he said. No, I said, you go back and run it again. So he says, I went back, ran it again. And I could see the same thing was happening.
Yeah.
But he says, one day I was at breakfast, and this gentleman who I casually knew was there. And he asked me how things are going, and I told him. And he says, what I'd like to do is really get going on my own. So the guy said, okay, he said, they left the restaurant. He said, get in my car. So he got in the car, and he took Jim to the First National Bank and walked in, asked to see the president. And they walked in, and he said, this guy obviously knew him well, and said, this guy needs some help. Set up a company. That's how.
Oh my God!
That's how it all happened.
Oh geez!
Isn't that amazing?
Talk about amazing! Wow!
Yeah. So that was. Anyway, Jim is just such a great fella.
Uh-huh.
He has put in a lot of his own money into the club.
Yeah.
For projects and things like that, because he's able to. And
does he live out here?
Yeah.
Oh, he does. Okay.
Sure.
Okay.
Jim and Pat, and they have five boys.
Okay.
And they have a nice place in Florida, which they go to in the
mm-hmm.
wintertime. So,
mm-hmm.
anyhow.
Well, I'll be done.
Yeah.